Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here with another installment. This is episode 4 of our 6-part session on this day of prayer and fasting for true Israel. And we're progressing more and more into the subject matter of the fact that worldwide Jewry is the enemy of Yahweh, and that our people, true Israel, need to understand this message, who true Israel is, who the covenant people are, and the enemy, our enemy, world organized Jewry, who have been pretending to be Israel for the last 2,000 years. Our people need to be straightened out in this matter. Isn't that correct, William Fink?
Well, absolutely, and it's crucial to what's going on in the world today is identifying the parties of yesterday correctly.
Yes, yeah. So that if we don't know the cause of the disease, we can't effect a cure.
Absolutely
yes.
Not.
Correct.
That's what modern medicine does. They never know the cause of disease.
Yeah,
they
right.
Kill people with drugs.
You have a team of doctors all arguing about what the correct diagnosis is. The Judeo-Christians still haven't got it right. All right. Okay, so Bill, I'm going to let you take over. Have a good show, you and Clifton. I'll be checking in frequently. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. God bless. Have a good show.
Clifton, I thought I'd kick us off with a quote from an article I have here.
Yeah, I got your email here.
Okay. Bonaparte and Hitler versus the international bankers, and this appeared. It's an article by Stephen M. Goodson, and it appeared in the Bonds Review about 4 or 5 years ago. One of the most significant landmarks in the history of modern times took place in August of 1694, when the Bank of England was established by a retired pirate, William Paterson, who was fronting for a group of Amsterdam bankers. I wonder who they were. The initial prospectus stated openly that the bank has benefit of interest on all monies which it creates out of nothing. So they weren't even hiding it in 1694. The bank immediately granted King William III a loan of 1.2 million pounds in gold and silver coins at 8% interest per year, and then proceeded to print banknotes of the same amount. Today, the national debt of Britain exceeds 400 billion pounds, and this is 4 or 5 years ago, or 46.5% of national income. Eventually, these interest payments could not be funded by governments out of customs and excise taxes, and led to the almost worldwide introduction of a personal income tax about 100 years ago. This tax was first proposed by Karl Marx in 1848 as point number 2 of his Communist Manifesto. Numerous intellectuals, monetary reformers, and political leaders have attempted to eradicate the corrupt system of usury, which, in spite of the superabundance generated by the technological age, has been responsible for so much enslavement, poverty, and chaos. All wars, both major and minor, of the last 3 centuries may be linked to the usurious system of debt slavery. And what do you think about that, Clifton? Is that what we're living under today or what?
Oh yeah, that's right. We're called indentured slaves, and
well, we're in debt as soon as we're born.
Yeah, in when Abraham Lincoln had his greenbacks out, you know, and the Bank of England fought that real, they had a hazard report, and they explained the difference between their type of slavery and the American type of slavery. The fact that in America, the slave owners had to take care of the slaves, you know. So they were, the slaves were better off in the southern states than we are here today. And then they explained that, their type of slavery would be through the money.
So, absolutely. They've enslaved us through these false fiscal systems, these false economic systems that we've had. Is there any particular place you'd like to start, or is there anything you want to discuss?
Well, I'm sure that the subject of the Jubilee was supposed to be brought up because of Eli's emails. He sent several out on it, and so I got up some material on that. What I'm going to bring up, I don't want to be antagonistic, and I want to present this humbly, but it is my opinion that before a Jubilee is declared, that it is mandatory, the prophecy at Obadiah 18, that's Obadiah verse 18 is only one verse in Obadiah, be fulfilled, which states, and the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble, and they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall be not and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for Yahweh hath spoken it. It is, if the objective is to destroy the power of the Edomites, claiming to be Judahites, this passage gives us the answer. Here it appears that the house of Jacob would include all the 12 tribes of Israel, in all places to where they have migrated and settled. But it seems that the prophet here is especially pointing out the house of Joseph, which would be representative today of Britain and the United States of America. Now, the only way today that the house of Esau can become stubble before the flame of the house of Joseph is for both America and Britain to learn the two seed line message of Genesis 3:15. By and large, the two seed line message is only being taught by about 5% in Israel identity circles in America, and nearly 0% in Britain among those teaching British Israel. If one will observe the status of a two seed line message of Genesis 3:15 as it exists today, it doesn't stand the prospect of the allegorical snowball in hell. But be of good cheer. The prophet said it would happen, and it will, and nothing can prevent it from happening come hell or high water. But until it does happen, declaring a Jubilee is out of the question. But this is no reason we shouldn't consider the ramifications of what a Jubilee would do for us, we Israelites. Do you have any comment on that, Bill?
Well, just, you know, I'm just trying to be a spark. That's all, and that's all that one individual can hope for. Is that we be a spark in the eventual ignition of the house of Jacob. The debt money system that we're under is imposed on us by the Edomite Jew. There is no doubt it comes right from the Talmud, and the Edomite Jew has imposed this debt money system on the entire, well, on Christendom first, and then on the entire world. Now, that is the entire debt money system has us all enslaved to a handful of Jewish banking families in New York and London. Yeah. And there's no way that we're ever going to break free of that without the recognition of the prophecies in the book concerning the Edomite Jews. And that takes identifying who they are.
Well, they'll never be identified unless we get on the ball on this two-seed line message.
Well, that's exactly true, but most people in identity don't want to hear it. I mean, we have far too many people listening to far too many clowns that are probably, quite a great number of them, are probably financed by the enemy. Ted Wieland is probably financed by the Jews.
You have
I
to wonder.
I wouldn't doubt it for one bit.
You have to wonder, really, that some of these are so venomous against Tucci line. You have to wonder if they aren't getting paid by somebody.
They had plenty of money to publish all the books they want, take out all of the advertisements they want. Pete Peters has his own 24/7 radio station. It seems to me that the anti-Tucci liners and identity are all very well financed, and the Tucci liners, well, we're all very poor.
But the stubble's not going to feel the flame, Joseph's flame, until this Tucci line and the enemy is already feeling this. The heat of it to some extent, because they don't like what they hear, and it's like the Bible says that they'll be gritting their teeth.
Absolutely. Tucci line, you know, to me, Tucci line is the only theological position that meshes all of the New Testament and the Old Testament and all of history in perfect synchronicity. Everything blends right together, and every piece of this puzzle snaps into place perfectly.
Yeah, and you know, the Old Testament isn't the only place that talks about a jubilee. First of all, I'd like to cite some passages in the New Testament which parallel the subject of the jubilee in the Old Testament. Luke 4:18-19. The Spirit of Yahweh is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recover the sight of the blind, and to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of Yahweh. And if you go over that verse there, who are the gospel to the poor? Who are the poor? I mean, since we've been divorced, you know, we've had a battle uphill, you know, for 2,700 years economically, all the tribes. And then who are the brokenhearted? I think the story in the New Testament there that when Christ was born, and what tribe is that guy from? And wasn't it Anna said something about it?
Anna, the prophetess, she was of the tribe of Asher, yes.
Yeah, and they more or less confirmed that we were in darkness and so on. And then the deliverance of the captives. Well, who was captive except the tribes of Israel, and, you know, including, you know, Judah went into Assyrian captive also, which is something that the British Israel misses out on, you know, continually. They hardly ever mention it.
Well, that's something that a lot of people aren't. That's something that the Ephraim Scepter heretics also push, also miss, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Most of Judah actually became Scythians with most of Israel. And they're in Europe also.
Yeah, right. And it speaks recovering the sight of the blind. Well, who's any blinder than Israel? I mean, we go out here and try to tell these people some of these things, and they can't even listen to us for 5 minutes.
Well, you know, I've always told people it's not a mistake that in John chapter 8, Yahshua Christ identifies the Edomite Jews as the children of Satan. And in John chapter 10, he gives the great discourse of the sheep. However, right in between those two very important chapters, in John chapter 9, he heals a man who was blind from birth. And where's that man?
Well, he was a typical Israelite, only he was physically blind, you know, also. He was doubly blind, probably.
Well, what I'm saying is that we're not going to have our eyes opened until we identify
the enemy
and the sheep.
It takes Christ to remove the blindness. I mean, we should be really thankful if the blindness has been removed from us. And then we should feel sorry for these other people that are blind and they can't even conceive what you're talking about when you try to talk about some of these things to them.
Absolutely.
And then it says opening the prison and the opening of the prison to them that are bound. Well, you know this whole thing, you know, we're responsible for our actions. You know, I found a place in the Bible where we're even supposed to ask forgiveness of our forefathers' sins. And they sinned, and they were divorced, and they sold themselves out to sin. So we are the people that are bound. We're like a prisoner. We're in a prison and bound.
Absolutely.
So every part of this verse that Christ speaks about here. I got ahead of myself a little. In Luke there, it just says to set at liberty them that are bruised. But see, that verse is found also in the Old Testament at Isaiah 61, which state, the Spirit of Yahweh Elohim is upon me, because Yahweh hath anointed me to preach the good tidings unto the meek. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound.
Well, right, but that the line about being them that are bruised, that actually comes from Isaiah 58:6, and it's consistent in all Greek manuscripts.
I wasn't aware that it's also in Isaiah, but it's here in Isaiah 61:1. And so this thing about a jubilee, it's an Israelite institution, and it's for Israelites only, and it's not for anybody else, and nobody else should have any benefits. And believe it or not, I have, if I get time to present it here, one of the concordances says as much. And you know, I mean, one of the Bible dictionaries, not a concordance, but a Bible dictionary says as much. And but then we also find allusion to, John 8:31 through 36, it also alludes to the Jubilee. Then said Joshua to those Judeans, which believed on him, if you continue in my word, then ye are my disciples indeed, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. They answered him, we be Abraham's seed, and were never in bondage to any man. How saith ye shall be made free? Joshua answered them, verily, verily, I say unto you, whosoever committeth sin is the servant of sin, and the servant abideth not in the house forever, but the Son abideth forever. If the Son, Yahshua, meaning Yahshua, therefore shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. So it's very clear here that it's very clear here that the one that sets us free is Yahshua. So we can't, Yahshua is the one that's going to declare a jubilee, not us. And I don't want to be arrogant about it. Like I said before, I want to be humble about it, but I'm not jumping on the band of pronouncing a jubilee at the present time.
Yeah, right. Well, I think part of Eli's purpose is simply to you know, prayer and fasting and to pray that we're released. Which,
well, I have no objection to that.
Which introduces a jubilee. I mean, when Yahshua returns, we're going to be released. There
I have no
doubt.
Objection to that. And But, you know, I want to approach the subject humbly, and it's something that we really should talk about. And Adam
right,
Clark,
we have no jubilee until Yahshua returns. I agree with that.
Now, Adam Clark has had some pretty, you know, if you get a commentary, you know, maybe you ought to get his first. It's kind of hard to find these old six-volume, you know, you have to kind of find it in used bookstores around. And I think I paid $200 for mine or better. But anyway, Adam Clark in his six-volume commentary, volume 5, page 49, comments thusly, and that would be on this last one thing. And the servant abideth not in the house, or rather, now the slave abideth not in the family. That's his answer to it. As if Jesus had said, a slave has no right to any part of the inheritance in the family to which he belongs, but the son, the legitimate son, has the right. He can make any servant of the family free, though no, got to turn the page here, slave can. A slave can't do that. Only those who are genuine children can inherit the estate. If sons, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ. And then he gives the references at Galatians 4, 21 through 31, and then Romans 8, 17. Do you have anything you'd want to say about what Paul has to say about this?
No, I'm not even prepared to discuss this, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, I thought maybe you'd recognize those. I don't know whether I think I made a printout, but it.
Well, I'm, you know, it's absolutely clear that Paul addressing these Galatians is addressing part of dispersed Israel.
Yeah, right.
And the whole book of Galatians is exclusive to dispersed Israel.
And
he explains to them that they are the children of Isaac.
I think it's in Galatians where Paul talks about the bondwoman, you know, compared to the free woman. And I think that's what that passage is about. But nevertheless, it's kind of indirectly connected with the Jubilee.
Right. And the church, you know, they try to teach that Ishmaelites or Arabs can be brought into Christianity now. But Paul is clearly excluding them.
Well, there's one thing about it. They can't be freed by a Jubilee.
Well, no, neither. Well, the Jubilee is only for the children,
and,
right?
And Paul as much says so.
Right. And the year of release, that only, all through the law, that only accounts for Israelites.
Right.
That's not for strangers. None of those financial or fiscal laws or economic laws are for strangers. We're told when a stranger comes into our land and wants to borrow money, we have to charge them interest. And we're forbidden from charging our brethren interest.
Right.
In other words, usury is only valid in the Old Testament so that the strangers don't take advantage of us in our own land. And that's spelled out in Scripture.
Yeah. Well, anyway, from these passages, it's very clear who has the power to initiate a Jubilee and who the beneficiaries are, and that person is Yahshua Christ alone. Adam Clark, he goes a little bit, he understands the languages a little bit better than some of the other commentators. He learned several different languages, and he makes a statement in his commentary, volume 1, page 592, saying the literal meaning of the word Jubilee, Josephus, and the rabbins, R-A-B-B-I-N-S, the way he spells it, have caused many to err. The rabbins say it signifies a ram's horn because the trumpets, which were used in proclaiming the solemnity, were made out of ram's horns.
Yeah, they sell them. They sell them today. They're called shofars. They sell them today to dumb Christians that buy things from Jews.
Well, anyway, he goes on to say this is adopted in a few places in our translations, but none of the ancient versions acknowledge this sense of the term. The Chaldee accepted, so evidently in the Chaldee it may say that. But he goes on and says, some derive it from Y-A-B-A-L, which is the English equivalent to the Hebrew word, to bring, to carry away, because the Israelites at this time carried away the right of repossessing their inheritance, which had been forfeited or alienated. The most natural derivation is from Hobil, H-O-B-I-L, to cause, to bring back, to recall, because estates and so forth, which had been alienated, were then brought back to their primitive owners. And you probably don't have anything. He's probably speaking the of the Hebrew language here, and you're probably not familiar with what he has to say, right?
No, I have a Hebrew vocabulary, but not that extensive.
But anyway, when Adam Clark says something about that, I kind of sit up and listen, because he seems to be right. You know, he was right about Rahab, I believe. And but this brings another thing. You know, we aren't entirely without a Jubilee here in the United States right now. And I'm talking about the Liberty Bell. And from the World Book Encyclopedia, copyright 1971, volume 12, page 2 to 10, it says, Liberty Bell is a treasured relic of the early days of American independence.
It's another idol.
It was rung July 8, 1776, with other church bells to announce the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. Its inscription proclaimed liberty throughout the land unto the inhabitants thereof. I should have had quotes around that. It's from the Bible, Leviticus 25:10.
And it cracked, didn't it?
Well, it's
what are the odds of that?
Oh, I'll tell you when it cracked. It cracked when there was a Supreme Court judge by the name of John Marshall, I think his name was, or something like that. Yeah, John Marshall, when he died, and it was at his funeral when they rang it, it cracked. So I maybe that was the end of justice in the United States.
I might be wrong, but I think he might be connected to that decision about corporations having a voice, that corporations could be persons. It's been a long time since I read on that, but I think he might be connected to that.
Uh-huh.
Which actually was the beginning of the end for freedom in this country, that's for sure.
Anyway, in the second paragraph, then, the Liberty Bell weighs more than 2,080 pounds. The province of Pennsylvania paid $300 for it in 1752. It is now in the first floor tower room of Independence Hall in Philadelphia. A printed card gives it's, oh, there's a printed card, you know, next to the bell that gives its history, and that's what the card says. By order of the Assembly of the Province of Pennsylvania for the State of State House of Pennsylvania, pass and show. Now, I don't know what that means. It's evidently a town by the name of Pass and Show, Philadelphia, and then it's got 1776 in Roman numerals. This bell was first cast in England. It broke in ringing after it arrived, and was recast in Philadelphia from the same metal with the same inscription in 1753. In the adjoining yard, it rang at each successive anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence until 1835. It broke July July 8th that year while tolling during the funeral solemnities of John Marshall, Chief Justice of the United States, who died in this city. Now, it says the same inscription, so I wonder if that inscription was on that when it came from England. Did you ever hear anything about anything like that?
It would seem to me odd that that inscription was put on a bell in England to be sent here, but I mean, I don't know. I don't know that much of the history.
It was recast, and then it had the same inscription. That's the only thing, you know.
Right. I just know that we you know, this country had a nation, as a nation, we had a relative period of financial history, and that was from the time that Andrew Jackson ejected the Central Bank of the United States, the Second Bank of the United States.
And I wanted to say something about Andrew Jackson because he's the second man after Christ to drive the money changers out of the temple, and there hasn't been anybody since.
Right, not here, that's for sure.
I know that he's no Jesus Christ, but...
Absolutely not, but he's. I count him as the last great president, that's for sure. I mean, Kennedy and Lincoln made a lot of mistakes, but he did stand up to the money changers. And Kennedy tried to stand up for the money changers, and they killed them both. Well, they tried to kill Andrew Jackson, too. But
they made an attempt on his life.
There was a gentleman with two pistols that fired two shots at him. Both pistols misfired.
Yeah, right. That's what happened.
And the guy was found not guilty by reason of insanity.
Yeah, he pled insanity right away.
And he got off.
He
bragged later about being hired by the powerful people in Europe that promised him that he would get off if he got caught.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, whether or not that's hearsay more or less, but it's part of our history.
Well, from that time on, it was kind of the end of the ringing of the bell except for one occasion. And the last paragraph of this quote from the World Book Encyclopedia says, "The Liberty Bell is no longer rung, but it has been struck on special occasion. On June 6, 1944, when the Allies' forces landed in France, a Philadelphia official struck the bell. Spatial sound equipment picked up the tone, amplified it, and broadcast it to all parts of the United States. Officials rang a larger bell in the steeple of Independence Hall to announce America's entry into World War One." It says World War One, so that wasn't in World War Two. You know that happened, World War One. But that's a poor excuse for ringing a Liberty Bell when we're going over there to be massacred.
Well, you know, to the Jews, that's a great thing. And they've been running things since at least 1913, so.
But, you know, there's implications to this Liberty Bell thing. You know, they won't let us put up the... Ten Commandments in the classrooms and in schools or any public buildings and this. But here's this Liberty Bell that's got this inscription of a verse in the Bible. Now, I think that ought to be put in every that inscription ought to be put in every post office in the land because they put out all these Liberty Bell stamps here lately. And they're pushing, you know, they pushed them real hard, you know.
Well, that's because, you know, it's propagandizing the people. They constantly propagandize Americans that Americans are free. It's the great lie. Repeat something enough and people believe it. You ask the average American in the street today, are you a free man? And he'd wonder what you were nuts for even asking that question. Of course he's a free man. When in reality, he's a total slave.
But anyway, I think the thing sets there is kind of a witness that we're a Christian nation, and it could be used in, you know, if somebody wanted to go to the trouble of having some kind of lawsuit.
Well, right, you're correct.
Class action lawsuit, say, well, here is the forefathers' intent. They intended, they quoted the Bible, so... we're a Christian nation, and get the Ten Commandments and all this stuff back into schools.
Well, right, but Clifton is a million relics from the period, from the 1700s that prove.
Well, yeah, that's probably true, too.
They just don't teach anybody in the schools about them.
Right.
They don't teach any history in the school.
They don't teach anything about this liberty. I never learned anything about the Liberty Bell in school.
Okay, but I mean, we've lost our educational system when they, in the mid-1800s, when they started certain states, I think Massachusetts was the leader, started requiring everybody to get a 12-year education. And it was pretty clear back then that they started to remove classical education from the schools because not everybody can withstand a classical education. Not everybody is up to or is intelligent enough to gain it to acquire a classical education. That's just a fact of life. And they started dumbing down the schools as soon as they started requiring that everybody go to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that everybody go to them for 12 years.
But anyway, I was thinking that this might be, you know, if somebody wanted to do something, they might get up a thing. The only we would have to override the Supreme Court on our beliefs, you know. And see, the only way that I see that we could do it is with an amendment to the Constitution to and use the Liberty Bell as a witness that...
Right, but that's never... I'm sorry, that's never going to happen.
I know that it would be a hard thing to bring about because...
There's no correcting this system. There's no political solution.
If anybody took it to court... And they say, well, now you have to have two-thirds of the states on this. Well, then it could be argued, well, when they passed the income tax thing, there was only three states approved it. It could backfire on them. But, you know, that's just some of my, you know, stuff I kicked around in my mind. You know, it's just some of my own thoughts on it. But, you know, I doubt whether it would ever happen anyway. But
yeah,
are you familiar with the passages in Josephus about the Jubilee and that? He more or less verifies that there were Jubilees. And I should mention something else about a Jubilee that is not generally known. In the Bible, the Jubilee is... seven years of 7 years, and in other words, 49 years, and then the 50th year is the year of Jubilees.
Well, right, that's because every year was a Sabbath. Every seventh year was a Sabbath year anyway.
Yeah.
And you needed seven Sabbaths, and then the following year would be, yes, the 50th year is the Jubilee year, yes.
But to show you how phony the Book of Jubilees is, they only have 7 years of Jubilee, and then they don't have a year of Jubilee. They have just they have 49 years, and then they don't have a 50th year, and then they start counting 49 over again like that. And it's not biblical at all. Jubilees isn't.
Well, the Book of Jubilees was probably drawn on pre-existing biblical and apocryphal material and written in the 2nd century B.C.
I have about 150 B.C., something like that, the information I have on...
Yeah, well, that's the 2nd century B.C.
But are you aware, too, that the Catholic Church declared a Jubilee?
Oh yeah, they had everybody enslaved for 1,200 years. What kind of jubilee did they declare?
Now let me see if I can find it here.
Did they free any little boys from the clutches of those priests?
let's see here. Oh, I can't find it right now. Yeah. Okay, I found this in an old can't think of the name of it, but it's about a 15 volume or so, a universal knowledge or something like that. And they had something in there on the Jubilee too, but they had I thought I'd mentioned the Catholics have a Jubilee. And quoting from it, their Jubilee or Jubilee Year, an institution of the Roman Catholic Church, the name of which is borrowed from that of the Jewish Jubilee.
Yeah, right. Jew never had a Jubilee. They don't have them today. That proves they're not the Hebrews
right?
of the Old Testament. I've never seen a Jew say anything about a Jubilee.
You know,
they wouldn't let their mother off alone.
At least this shows the thinking of the people back, you know, in about the middle 1800s. That's when those books were printed. The Catholic Jubilee is of two kinds, ordinary and extraordinary. The ordinary Jubilee is that which is celebrated at stated intervals, the length of which has varied at different times. Its origin is traced to Pope Boniface the 8th, Pope Boniface the 8th, who issued for the year 1300 a bull granting a plenary indulgence, whatever kind of indulgence that is, confessing their sins and visiting the Church of St. Peter and St. Paul 15 times as strangers and 30 times if a resident of the city. The invitation was accepted with marvelous enthusiasm. Innumerable troops of pilgrims from every part of the church flocked to Rome. Giovanni Vallini, V-A-I-L-L-A-N-I is the last name, a contemporary chronicler, states that the constant number of pilgrims in Rome, not reckoning those who were on the road going and returning during the entire year, never fell below 200,000. As instituted by Boniface, the Jubilee was to have been held every 100 years. Clement the IV, in obedience to an earnest request from the people of Rome, abridged the time to 50 years. His jubilee, accordingly, took place in 1550, and was even more numerously attended than that of Boniface. The average number of pilgrims until the heats of summer suspended their frequency, being, according to Matthew Vallini, no fewer than 1 million. The term interval was still further abridged by Urban the Sixth, and again by Paul the Second, who in 1470, get to change pages here, ordered that henceforth each 25th year should be held a jubilee. In other words, have a jubilee every 25 years. And an arrangement which has continued ever since to regulate the ordinary jubilee. Paul II extended still more in another way the spiritual advantage of the jubilee by dispensing with the personal pilgrimage to Rome and granting the indulgence to all who should visit any church in their home country designated or for the purpose, and should it should, if their means permitted, contribute a sum towards the expenses of the holy wars.
Well, that's all they were looking for was money. That's not a jubilee.
I've read really the meat of this. You know, there's no use to reading the rest of it.
That's the church for you. They tried to turn a jubilee into a scheme to get more money.
Well, you know, I can remember as a kid, you know, I'm talking back in 39 or 40, something like 38, 39, 40, you know. And I used to live, we used to live on Route 23, about a mile north of Fostoria. And of course, they didn't have interstate highways in those days. And every year, about a certain time, it was around the last part of August would be in there someplace, you know. All these cars from Toledo and Detroit, they come streaming, you know, just car after car after car, and they was headed for Cary, Ohio, which is about 15 miles south of Fostoria, and they had some saint in there, and those people was going down there kissing the big toe of that saint. And that's what they was, you know, and they probably paid dearly for kissing the foot.
Yeah, well, they would deserve to pay dearly for kissing some saint's foot.
And I can imagine that that toe, after a few kisses, was just loaded with saliva.
If you want to make a saint, you go kiss your wife. You'll make a saint.
But I just thought I'd bring that up, that the Catholic has their own version of the Jubilee. So,
Yeah, a scheme to make money. That's what that's exposed as. I mean, they want to give you an indulgence if you go to your local church and fork over some money. That's the church for you. That's typical Catholics.
But anyway, Nelson's new illustrated Bible dictionary is probably, they give the most concise and best write-up on the Jubilee that I could find, and in about the fourth paragraph down, they write this: the rights and privileges extended by the Israelites to other Israelites did not extend to non-Israelites. I'll read that over. The rights and privilege extended by the Israelites to other Israelites did not extend to other Israelites. Servants obtained by Israelites from non-Israelites were permitted slaves. Let me read this over again. Servants obtained by Israelites from non-Israelites world from is oh I get it I'm reading the world for I'm saying wood Israelites obtained by Israelites servants obtained by Israelites from non-Israelite world were permanent slaves. The property purchased from non-Israelites was not redeemable. The law of the year of Jubilee favored the Israelites. I hope I didn't read that.
Well, the law was only for Israel, period. And it didn't apply to the other races unless the law was about the other races, even the other Adamites. The law was for Israel. There's no doubt. It's Deuteronomy 23:19 says, thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother. Usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. And then in 20 it says, unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury. And all of the other laws concerning release only affect, all of the economic laws only affected Israelites.
I was thinking you was telling me somewhere along the line they redefined the term usury.
Well, I discussed that in my first segment today, where the Catholic Church actually redefined usury. And the Protestants followed it to mean that you couldn't, they redefined it to mean that anything anything that cost nothing or that wasn't put to work in production, you could not profit from. That's how they defined usury. That's how they redefined usury. And then they redefined money to mean that, you know, they redefined the perception of money and said that money is used in the production of goods.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they justify usury today.
And if they hadn't have redefined it, we might not be bothered with usury today, right?
Well, if they hadn't have redefined usury, and the Catholics did it, and I showed that the Protestants did it also, they wouldn't be able to consider themselves Christians because they're in direct violation of Yahweh's law, the law of the Bible. So what they did was they redefined usury to make it appear that they're not in violation of the law. But of course they are, but they're self-justified anyway. That proves that they're self-justified.
I see something here through our conversation right now that I haven't been able to see through before. It's like when we go and have a bank account at the bank, it's all right for us to take usury from them, isn't it?
Well,
if they represent the Jews.
Well, yeah, but you see, in reality, you're feeding into the Jewish system.
Yeah,
And allowing the Jews to subjugate your brethren. Because, you know, they're all white people with loans out. That the Jews are, the parasites are feeding off of. So, yes, by having money in a bank, even if your money in the bank is not collecting interest, You are empowering the Jews.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, we're all.
And indirectly, another Israelite might be paying a lot of interest, so you can collect a little bit.
Right. Exactly. You're empowering them. And it's a very difficult system to stay out of. I can't stay out of it because of my personal situation. But it's even for most people, it's an extremely difficult situation. You can avoid having a bank account, yes, by holding on to your cash, by purchasing money orders when you want to mail money. And I mean, there's still a way around it, but it makes your life a lot, you know, I mean, you lose all the conveniences of modern life by doing so. I mean, not that they're important. We shouldn't seek them. You know, I mean, it's possible to stay out of the system, though, for most people. But nobody does it.
I think my checking account, sometimes they give me $3 or $4, something like that, a month, which is, it's almost an insult.
Well, right. The depending on how much money you have in a bank, I mean, you could have $1,000 in the bank and get pennies each month in interest right now, the way the interest rates are.
Yeah.
But try owing the bank $1,000 and see how much interest they're going to charge you. They're going to charge you 14, 16, 18,
yeah, just 20%. Try overdrafting just one time and see how big a penalty you get.
Yeah, it's a system of slavery.
I have enough in the bank that I don't have to worry about that too much. So I really thought we were going to
spend most of our program discussing the economic history of the United States.
Well, yeah, I wanted to. I got one more thing that I would like to bring out about this Jubilee thing. And I find this in Zondervan's Pictorial Encyclopedia under Jubilee Year. And actually the first thing they first item they bring up is I'll skip the verses and stuff. It says it underlay the case of the daughters of Zelophehad. I can't hardly pronounce that. It's one of the $60,000 words in which it was ruled that an heiress in possession could not marry outside her tribe because her property would then not revert to her family, even at the year of Jubilee. Now, what that passage is about is Zelophehad, these daughters of Zelophehad, the males had died in their family.
Right, and this actually was a decision that gave women the ability to inherit.
Yeah, the women got the inheritance then, and that was kind of like a Moses kind of, you know, it went to Moses, so it would be parallel to us going to the Supreme Court, you know, and he ruled in favor of the daughters. But what I wanted to point out here, I think the women be interested in this passage because when Zedekiah, when Nebuchadnezzar came down, you know, Babylon came down and they got Nebuchadnezzar and his sons, and they killed all of his sons, so that left only the daughters to carry on. And Nebuchadnezzar was not aware of that, or he would have killed the daughters too. But Jeremiah took the daughters on up to Britain, and he left one off at Spain, I understand, and he took the other into Britain. And upon that action, because their father was a king, they automatically became queens. So he took Tiatefi up to Britain, and of course she married with royalty up there. But I think the women be interested to know that here's a case where a woman bridged over the seat of David. And I believe that the present queens, Queen Elizabeth I and II, and what was the one queen there that was a friend to the Jew?
Victoria.
Victoria, yeah. I think that would even, this Jubilee thing even covers them to, as long as there's no males to be king, for a queen to sit on the throne. I think the women need something on their side.
Well, something that I wanted to get into in my first segment that I didn't have the time. I didn't have the time to get into a lot of things I wanted to. What was that, you know, when the Jews introduced the shitar into English law, before that, the English were basically practicing an old Israelite law or custom or however you want to view it, that the land would never leave the family. The land never left the ownership of the people that owned it, of the people that had it. But when the Jews introduced the shitar, debtors were able to get the land away from the family.
But the exception is here in the rule that the woman in the case of like the queen isn't supposed to marry out of her family. And she
right
has,
in the Old Testament that's true. I mean we've destroyed that, of course.
Yeah.
But you know we basically lost our tribal identification with the deportations from the Assyrians. So.
So Queen Elizabeth II has broken the law by marrying out of her own family tree.
Well, absolutely, but she married an Edomite, so
yeah,
I mean, and you know, he couldn't possibly be of her family tree.
Yeah.
Even you know, even if she, there's no way. I mean, yeah, that's a straight violation of the law.
But anyway, where did you want to go on this monetary thing? And how
well,
much
I mean, I thought you sent me 30 pages of notes here from 1757. So,
yeah,
where
did you want to start in on that?
Well, it's sort of we've already spent an hour. We have about 45 minutes left.
Uh huh.
Well,
I didn't intend to take this long, but I just wanted to state my position on the Jubilee.
Yeah, I know, and I thought that would take 5 minutes the way you indicated to me before we did the program. That's about what I thought.
Well, I just wanted everybody to realize it's a bigger subject than you might, and there's a lot of considerations.
Well, right, but I mean, everybody here should understand that we really have no release until Yahshua, until Shiloh comes. That's the way it is. That's, I mean, we're not going to be free of the Edomites, of slavery, until the Edomites are gone.
Yeah. But I see here, according to this thing that I made up and I sent you a copy of it, in 1024 is the first they start talking about the money changers. But I have to question a little bit, because William the Conqueror didn't come in with his Jewish friends until 1066. Now, there must have been a few Jews in England before 1066.
Well, the period of the goldsmith started in the 1100s.
Well, I have 1024 on here, so, you know, 1100 would sound better, because that would put them after William the Conqueror. Because William the Conqueror deliberately brought in the Jews with their coins.
Yes, it's very unlikely there were Jews in England before the time of William. I mean, I'm not saying it's not possible. I have absolutely no indication of it in anything I've ever read.
Well, you know, this guy that wrote a history...
Except that there were some Jews in, you know, there were some Judeans in Roman times in Britain. That is true.
Uh-huh.
Now, whether or not they were Edomites they were probably from both sorts. But there were some Judeans in Britain in Roman times.
Well, you know, this date here could be wrong on this 1024. It sounds to me like something the Jew, because they set up a
well, they were doing this in France too in the 12 and 1300s, but
uh-huh.
Yeah, it didn't. It was after 1024, I'm sure.
And you covered that pretty well in your former
yes
thing. Well, in 1757, like, it's kind of the beginning of the subject of. The financial history of the United States, and so it kind of starts with Benjamin Franklin in 1757. Benjamin Franklin travels to England and would have spent the next 18 years of his life there until just before the start of the American Revolution. I think it was while he was in England in 1760, Meyer Amschel Bauer changes his name to Meyer Amschel Rothschild and sets up the House of Rothschild, and soon learns that if he loans out money to the governments and royalty, then this is far more profitable than loaning to individuals. This is because the loans made are bigger and backed by their nation's taxes. He trains his five sons in the art of money creation.
Yeah, it's not really an art. It's pretty easy to do. The hard thing to do is, you know, corrupting. In our eyes, I mean, we're not corruptors.
Well, it's kind of the art of the shell game, isn't it?
Right. Anybody can print money, but then you have to go corrupt the government officials to give you the privilege to come. You know, to print the money without going to prison for it. So,
anyway, in 1764, Benjamin Franklin is asked by officials in the Bank of England to explain the prosperity of the colonies in America, and he replies, quote, "This is simple. In the colonies, we issue our own money. It is called colonial scrip. We issue it in proper proportion to the demand of trade and industry to make the products pass easily from the producers to the consumers. In this manner, creating ourselves our own paper money, we control its purchasing power, and we have no interest to pay no one." Our interest, the money that we carry right now is drawing interest. And it's like the United States notes that...
Well, right. That's the problem with our economy, is that every dollar, when it's introduced to the economy, automatically requires more money than it represents. And that's what the chief cause of the need for inflation is.
Well, they deliberately put a lot of money into circulation with the thought of cutting it off before the, you know, they know that the person, like a person buys a house, he's going to pay it off in 10 years maybe, and they know that he's going to pay it off in 10 years, so they give him a lot of money to buy that house, and about the ninth year, they cut off the money supply, and the guy gets out of work, and he can't.
Well, right, that's what happened with the Great Depression.
Yeah. And but it's like a pump, you know. You probably don't remember the old pumps like I do back in the 40s, like I lived out in the country there, and you always saved a little bit of water because you had to go out there and prime it. That's the first thing you had to do. You had to prime that pump, and then you pump that handle up and down to bring that water up out of the ground, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We already invented electric pumps and faucets by the time I grew up. By the time I was born.
Anyway, you get in trouble around the house if you didn't have enough water to prime that pump again.
Yeah,
and also, if you didn't release it, because in the wintertime, you release what prime was in there to leave the water back down so it don't freeze.
Right.
So in the wintertime, you take warm water out there and dump in the thing to... And then, do some pumping. But that's the way they do. They pump that handle up and down. You know, they raise the money supply and lower it, and they pump they pump the blood right out of the country.
Well, that's what they've been doing here for 100 years now, and they've been getting away with it, and they keep pumping.
Yeah. As a result of Franklin's statements, the British Parliament hurriedly passed the Currency Act of 1764. This prohibited colonial officials from issuing their own money and ordered them to pay all future taxes in gold and silver coins, referring to after this, odd way they've got this written, referring to after this act was passed, Franklin would state the following in his autobiography, quote, "In 1 year, the colonies were so reversed that the era of prosperity ended and a depression set in such an extent that the streets and colonies were filled with unemployed. The colonies would gladly have borne a little tax on tea and other matters had it not been for England, for them that England took away from the colonies their money, which created unemployment and dissatisfaction."
The reasons that we're given in as school children about the causes of the Revolutionary War are a lie. It was about the power to create money. And the power to manufacture your own goods were the two basic causes of the war.
All the tea was to show their frustration.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. It was the money powers in Europe, the Bank of England, that they, you know, they weren't profiting from American commerce.
So from this very time, America has never been free. They've been in bond to these Edomite Jews ever since.
Well, except for a period of about 70 years, yes, we have. We escaped from them from the period, from 1836 to 1913, we were pretty much free of them.
Well, they had the first Bank of the United States and the second Bank of the United States, which operated under the same way.
Yes, they did, but the charter, Andrew Jackson let the charter expire on a second bank.
Yeah, that's right. When he left that expire, of course, they continued the same type of banking. What they did then, because they couldn't get their blood money, they cut down the money supply and the per capita of person. It might have been, say, $25 per person. But they cut that down to maybe just a few cents per person in the entire United States.
Right, and that's a good term for it, blood money. And another thing I didn't get to cover this morning was the Merchant of Venice. The Merchant of Venice was a Jew, and Shylock, his loan shark, was a Jew. And Shakespeare was aware of who they were and what they were about. And he had Shylock saying in one place, you know, that we have to get our pound of flesh from this Christian. And that's exactly what he means.
Yeah.
That's, so Alexander Hamilton was the, you know, after the revolution, was the largest proponent of a privately owned central bank.
Well, he even started a bank during the revolutionary period, the Bank of North America, and then he was instrumental.
Well, that was begun in 1781.
I've got 1781 right here. Towards the end of the American Revolution, the Continental Congress were desperate for money, so they allowed Robert Morris, their financial superintendent, to open a privately owned central bank and hope that this would sort out the money problem. Morris was a wealthy man who had grown wealthy during the Revolution by trading in war materials.
Yes, and, I wonder how English he was. I'm sorry, go on.
This first central bank in America was called the Bank of North America, which was set up with a four-year charter and was closely modeled after the Bank of England. It was allowed to practice the fraudulent system of fractional reserve banking so it could create money. It didn't have then... charge interest on it. I don't like the way they've written this. The bank's charter called for private investors to put in $400,000 of capital, which Morris found himself unable to raise. Nevertheless, he unabashedly used his political influence to have gold deposited in the bank, which had been loaned to America by France. Morris was loaned the money he needed to buy this bank from this deposit of gold that belonged to the government, or rather the American people. Evidently, Morris must have been backed by one of the Rothschilds from France.
Well, right, and he got a loan from the government of France to the government of the United States, and then he took it and started a private bank with it. That's a nice gig. That's a nice scheme.
I wonder if I go over to France, whether they'd loan me some money to start a bank.
Well, I'm sure it's Benjamin Franklin again, because he was in France during this time. He was the United States ambassador to France.
Yeah, that's right. He was there, wasn't he?
And he probably talked the French. He was talking the French into loaning the American colonies money at this time. And that's, I'm sure, he was probably instrumental in enriching Mr. Morris. I wouldn't doubt it one bit. So we have the first privately owned. Well, I mean, at this time it's not really a central bank, but it's something close to a central bank, and that's in 1781. As soon as the Constitution, maybe even before the Constitution. Yeah, that's the Continental Congress. That's even before the Constitution is ratified.
Have you got this document on your computer?
Yes, I mean, you sent it to me.
Yeah, okay. What year are you on right now?
Well, we should be in 1785 now.
Oh, 1785. I'm 1791. So, okay, 1785. Despite the promises of Robert Morris that his privately owned Bank of North America would solve the problem with the money supply, of course, the economy continued to plummet, forcing the Continental Congress not to renew the bank's charter. The leader of the effort to kill this bank was William Finley of Pennsylvania, who stated this institution having no principle but that of avarice will never be varied in its objective to engross all the wealth, power, and influence of the state. Amschel Moses Rothschild moves his family home to a five-story home in Frankfurt, Germany, which he shares with the Schiff family, a descendant of both Rothschild and Schiff, Jacob Schiff, who would be born in this house, would be some 120 years later and be instrumental in setting up the Federal Reserve. He didn't live that long, but...
Well, it's...
Yeah, it says a descendant, yeah.
Schiff's a descendant of Rothschild.
Descendant of him 128 years later, yeah.
Right.
So,
And Schiff was born in Frankfurt, Germany.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's about 30 miles from my family's ancestral village in Germany.
By the way, all this information, might be somebody listening that might be interested where this information is coming from, and... It's called the History of the Money Changers, and it's on a website, www.jamthewitness.com. Derry Bradford Smith, underline, Bankers HTM. So I think if you just put History of the Money Changers in the search, it'll bring the site up. So, and they do pretty good from the very beginning. They start out with Caesar, B.C., I forget exactly what, 40 years or something B.C., until they get down to some of the latter banking, and then they start talking about these other third world countries and what they're doing there. So, about the last eight paragraphs, the rest of it's real good up until that ending part of it. So that's way up around 1960 or 70 in there someplace. So
notice there's the three main players behind the Bank of North America were Robert Morris, Alexander Hamilton, and the bank's president, Thomas Willing. Now, Hamilton was very influential. And he played a very important role in the early central banks of the United States. And he was actually, it's very likely he was of part Jewish blood. It's his mother was married to a guy named Levine, and she was not divorced from Levine. And Hamilton's, when she was having an affair with Hamilton's, the man that everybody thinks is Hamilton's father, and it's very possible that the Jew Levine was Hamilton's father.
Old material that I had, it said that his mother was French Huguenot and that his father was Jewish. But
would be her first husband, Levine.
Yeah, yeah. And then Alexander took his stepfather's name, so the name Hamilton is not Jewish.
Right.
But I took those three documents, and I transferred them over to a Microsoft Word document, so now I can delete them back, because I got the whole thing. And the one there, I had to take about 17, I had to save about 17 pages, you know, until I got all of it, but I got all of it, the autobiography of Alexander Hamilton, and I want to study that and just see. It appears, though, that Hamilton, even on the white side of his house, you know, the true Israelite side of his house, if they indeed were French Huguenots, it appears like his mother was a whore and his grandmother was a whore. Is that the way you read it, Bill, or...?
Well, yeah, there was absolutely, he was from absolutely unscrupulous backgrounds.
Kind of a double whore on the one side and a Jew on the other.
Yes, that's exactly what it seems to be.
So what do you expect out of a guy like that?
and it's only typical of the race. I mean, when you look at the 12 apostles, Judas was the Edomite, and he was the treasurer. And it seems to me that whenever something crucial happens in the history of our race, there's always some Jew with the purse strings.
I think Satan leads them, you know, right to us.
Absolutely. I wouldn't doubt it one bit. They always seem to be in the crucial places. I mean, look at the Civil War, the American Civil War, and both the treasurers of the Confederate States of America and the United States of America were Jews. Judah Benjamin in the South and Salmon Chase in the North.
Yeah,
and of course, Chase is the very Chase of Chase Manhattan banking fame. And yeah, they're both Jews on both sides.
Well, you know, a real interesting thing about that period of time is that Russia come to bat for us during the Civil War when Lincoln was having a problem with his money, you know, and he finally printed the greenbacks and was able to pay soldiers and win the war and all that. But the Rothschilds planned on having England coming into the North. And they had already shipped French to Mexico to come in on the side of the South. And I've got a 10-volume book. It was the 50th anniversary of the Civil War, and it was real good shape. I had to pay a real high price for it at a used bookstore. And now the paper in it is almost like new. That's what made it valuable. But the people had it rebound, you know, so that probably cost quite a bit of money. But those 10 volumes, when you look at the carnage that was in the Civil War, it's about as bad as it was in World War II.
Oh, the Civil War was, 500,000 good American, and they were nearly all white men died in the Civil War. And it was absolute carnage, and it was an absolute Jew heaven. England and France would have gotten involved in the Civil War on the side of the North, I believe. On the side of the South. However, Abraham Lincoln appealed to the Tsar of Russia, and the Tsar of Russia planted his navy.
Well, he
in the
did
shipping
that
lane.
Voluntarily. He sent the Rothschilds a note, and he says, "If you do that, he says that I'll consider that a declaration of war against Russia."
Right, but it was the Tsar of Russia that actually saved the Union.
Yeah, right.
And saved saved the North from having to deal with the English and the French also.
So they had to get even with the with Russia in World
in
War I.
The Bolshevik Revolution, absolutely. The Jews planned the Bolshevik Revolution, and they hated the Tsar because the Tsar wouldn't have the central bank. I mean, it was a different Tsar by then, but they still wouldn't have a Jewish-controlled central bank.
But can you imagine the amount of carnage that we would have had in this country? I understand it was building the, you know, I don't have the documentation, only one place. But I understand the English was building the biggest wooden ship that they ever built to send troops over to Canada to fight against us from the Canadian side.
Well, I don't know that, but I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, the word.
Yeah, I can't prove that, but you know, I'd appreciate it if anybody has any information on that. I'd like to have some, but I know that it's pretty well documented that the Tsar did send ships to San Francisco and to New York, I think it was. I forget where it was in the United States. They sent it someplace in the United States there anyway. And see that would help enforce the blockade if it was on the time too. You know, they had this blockade that they weren't allowing anything in and out of the country.
Absolutely, yeah. There were all kinds of the Rothschilds definitely had a hand in the War of 1812 and the American Civil War. And they've had a hand in all our wars, every single war in the last 300 years. Has been brought to us by the Jewish bankers of Europe.
Well, the very first war, you know, the War for Independence was caused by them.
Yes, it was.
And then they brought German, I guess mercenary isn't quite the right word there, but they brought Germans over here to fight against us, you know. And some of those Germans joined our side. We may not won that war if it hadn't been for that.
Well, yes, they did. They didn't want to fight for the Prince of Hesse, It was the Prince of Hesse that owed, I think he owed a debt. I'm not positive. I think he owed a debt to the King of England, and in return for the payment of the debt, or maybe he did it for money, but it was, it, they were not mercenaries. A mercenary is when the individual gets paid to fight. And these people are subjects of the Prince of Hesse. They are not being paid. They're being commanded to go to North America and fight. And the Prince of Hesse is the one that benefited from that. And I'm sure his generals were paid, that, you know, that had to come over here with them, but that's about it. And they, yeah, you're right. Most of them actually took off and blended in with the local German populations.
Yeah, and probably there's families in America today that goes back to people like that. You know, I have a person, you know, in my own family, on my mother's side, my great-grandmother's name was Crawford, and there was a Colonel William Crawford, was a personal friend to George Washington, and George Washington sent him here to Ohio to survey Ohio, you know, to so that they could, for these soldiers that had fought in the war, and they could parcel out pieces of ground, because it that was their way of paying them off for fighting in the war, you know. And I have a great grandfather by the name of Crawford on my mother's side, and the Indians caught him, and I don't know what the whole incident was about, but they caught him and they burned him at the stake down at near Cary, Ohio. And so I have you know, I Crawford, that sounds, you know, that I think that's Scottish.
Yes, probably.
Yeah. But Emma Heiser is German, so I'm German, Scottish, and Irish. And you know, there was a lot of Irish and Scottish that died in the Civil War.
Well, what happened was there were a lot of new, actually German and Irish immigrants in New York, and they were drafted right into the war.
Well, I never heard that they were drafted, but there was a
oh, yeah, there were draft riots in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the draft riots in New York City were actually right outside of a building that, and I have articles that prove this, of a building that became my family's brewery in the 1800s. Yeah, my great-great-grandfather bought the building, one of the buildings on the street of 39th Street in New York where the draft riots were, and in 1872 built his brewery there.
Well, you know, one of the first taxes we had in the United States was a tax on liquor.
I have a sword upstairs. It's an infantry sword that came down from my mother's side of the family. It's a Civil War sword.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a second cousin who possesses a Civil War sword from my father's side of the family.
Yeah, this set of books I got on the Civil War, you know, if you know somebody that was in the Civil War, you can almost go in that book and hunt them down and tell where they was at, and there might even be pictures of them there, because they've got a pretty good record of the Civil War on it. And I've never done a lot of reading in it, but I have them for reference.
Well, where do you want to go from here? I mean, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but 15 minutes.
Well,
I'd like to quote. I'd really like to quote. First, I'd like to say to Andrew Jackson that there was a second bank of the United States that was chartered after the North American Bank basically lost its charter. And this second bank of the United States, I think, lasted 10 years. And Andrew Jackson refused to renew its charter, and he almost lost his life for it. And I got a quote from Jackson, and this is from a Bonds Review article, and it's from Andrew Jackson's departing speech when he left office. And he warned us, and this speech he gave is extremely technical, and it's hard to find good sound bites from because it's so technical. But one thing he said was it was not easy for men engaged in the ordinary pursuits of business whose attention had not been particularly drawn to the subject to foresee all the consequences of a currency exclusively of paper. And we ought not on that account to be surprised at the facility with which laws were obtained to carry into effect the paper system. Honest and even enlightened men are sometimes misled by the specious and plausible statements of the designing. But experience has now proved the mischiefs and dangers of a paper company currency, and it rests with you to determine whether the proper remedy shall be applied. In other words, not to have another central bank based on a fiat paper currency. And he goes on and he explains all the sins that, and all the bad things that could happen and the corruption which is inevitable of having from having a central bank and a paper currency. And he goes on to say, to explain how the economy is easily manipulated and the rest of the banks in the country are easily controlled by when one central bank is allowed to have a paper currency. And this whole goodbye speech from Andrew Jackson is prophetic of everything that happened with the Federal Reserve 100 years later.
Yeah.
It was his farewell address that I'm reading from. And if anybody wants to Google Andrew Jackson's farewell address, this was printed in the Bonds Review. And it exposes the bankers for everything that they are. And this is in 1836. It's incredible. When you read this and you think about what happened in the 1900s, well, Andrew Jackson was right on the money about why he would not renew the charter for the central bank, the second bank of the United States.
Well, you see, in 1838, on January the 8th, President Jackson pays off the final installment of the national debt, which had been necessitated by allowing the banks to issue currency for government bonds rather than simply issuing treasury notes without such debt.
Right. Right now, the United States issues a bond and sells the bond to the Jews. To the bankers. And the bankers take the bond and they sell it to China. So they have no risk at all. But then they print money in place of the bond and give it to the government. When the government can just print the money in the first place and cut out the middleman and cut out China. Just print the money.
Not only that, but now they have a central bank in China that's like our Federal Reserve. And they're making money out of nothing like our Federal Reserve's doing, and they're buying up the real estate in our country. And that this boom and bust on this real estate, the Chinese are in on that real big.
Absolutely. And the Chinese had a huge role to play in the real estate bubble that happened over the last 10 years and it burst, that happened over the last 10 years in this country. And I read an article, it was in a fairly mainstream magazine, and somebody brought it to me because they knew I'd be interested in it, and I wish I had it, but I don't right now. But it basically explained how the Chinese manipulated our real estate market in the early years of this century. You know, in the late 90s, in 2000, 2001, 2000, until it burst. And the Chinese did that. There's no doubt. And it, we just won't hear about it on the 6 o'clock news.
I've heard a couple times on the news that the fact that there is a central bank in China.
Well, yeah, there is a central bank in China now, but they won't. I mean, the 6 o'clock news, they won't tell you what it's made of.
Well, they won't even tell you that our Federal Reserve is making money out of nothing, and then
right, they don't educate people.
Then as you carry it around in your pockets, it's collecting interest while you're carrying around.
Right. It's devaluating what you have.
The idea, I think the idea of trying to declare a jubilee here is to under a jubilee, all debt would be canceled. And, yeah, that would be great. But where my objection is, say, like some, you know, the people that run all the motels today are from India. These Indians from India, not the American Indians, but the Indians from India run practically all these hotels and stuff. Well, they probably have to loan money to buy and operate these hotels. Well, do we want to cancel everybody's debt and get them out of debt? This jubilee is an American, an Israelite institution. Why bail out foreigners?
Well, I mean, Yahshua is going to declare the next jubilee.
I think I demonstrated pretty
well.
By
the time that we have a jubilee, every plant that our Heavenly Father did not plant shall be rooted up.
And there isn't going to be any Edomites left.
I don't think there'll be any Indians or Chinese to be holding any debt when that happens.
I don't think so either.
That's just the way it is.
Here's the thing too. Say that you declared jubilee and you got the federal, you canceled the American debt. Well, the Federal Reserve could just transfer it over to China and charge you from there.
Absolutely. And they, you know, they've transferred everything else we have to China. I had hoped that we got through the 18 and possibly the 1900s with this today, and we're not going to do it. But I have, I had some quotes from Napoleon and from Adolf Hitler, and I'd like to give a few of them.
Well, go ahead.
Napoleon was printing his own money in France. And that's when the Rothschilds decided that they had to destroy him. And that's why they did it. And that's the only reason why England ever went to war with France. Napoleon was actually an Anglophile until the English went to war with him. And I know that he wanted to unite Europe and subjugate the German states, and being a German, I take offense to that. However, a lot of his motives were actually good, and he wanted to get the wolves out of the treasuries of France also, and he paid for it with his life. He paid for it with his government. He had to go to war with England because he had the nerve to print his own money. Adolf Hitler. And I'm going to quote from Mein Kampf from page 124. But at the beginning of May of 1919, a few days after the Communist Revolution had been terminated on May 1st, 1919, by the Bavarian Free Corps, Hitler was summoned as a member of the 2nd Infantry Regiment to attend a course on political instruction. The purpose of this course of lectures was to provide the soldiers with a background of politics, which would enable them to monitor the many revolutionary and political movements present in Munich at that time. Now, from Mein Kampf, from page 124, Hitler speaking, when I heard Gottfried Feder's first lecture on the abolition of the interest servitude, I understood immediately that here was a truth of transcendental importance for the future of the German people. The absolute separation of stock exchange capital from the economic life of the nation would make it possible to oppose the process of internationalization in German business without at the same time attacking capital as such. In other words, let the capital exist and the investment exist, but it shouldn't be the deciding factor in the fate of the nation and the manufacturers of the people. For to do this would jeopardize the foundations of our national independence, which, I mean, we, and I'm commenting, we have no national independence, mostly because of Wall Street. Back to Hitler. I clearly saw what was developing in Germany, and I realized then that the stiffest fight we would have to wage would not be against the enemy nations, but against international capital. In Feder's speech, I found an effective rallying cry for our coming struggle. The struggle against international finance capital and loan capital has become one of the most important points in the program on which the German nation has based its fight for economic freedom and independence. Now, no Jew could say these things. Unlike Roosevelt, Hitler didn't lie and deceive people into thinking that the so-called money changers had already fled from the temple. Hitler knew there would be a long fight ahead. Hitler fully understood the mechanizations of international capitalism. He understood the connection of that to the Jews, and he also knew the relationship of the bankers to the communists. He repeatedly emphasized the equality of globalism, international finance, and communism, and he explained it over and over again. Anyone who thinks that Hitler was a puppet, a Jew, or a pawn of the Jews is an idiot for not first investigating and realizing all of these things before they start talking about it. Here is where a lot of the theories that Hitler was a pawn for the Jews fails. If Hitler were a pawn for the Jews, Nazi Germany would have easily had a Jewish-owned central bank, and there would have never, ever been a reason for us or for the Jews to drag us into World War II, period. If Hitler was a flunky for the Jews, Germany would have had a central bank owned by the Jews, and it would have been over right there. World War II was fought because Germany would not put their hands, their fate, into the hands of the Jew bankers, just like the Bolshevik Revolution was necessitated by the Jews because the Russian Tsars wouldn't put the fate of their nation into the hands of the Jew bankers. Okay, end of sermon.
Yeah, you're talking about stuff that we weren't taught in school. I don't remember anything like that taught in school. We used to have civics in school, and they was telling, you know, how bad Hitler was, you know. I can remember.
Absolutely.
That.
And Hitler was a great man and a Christian, and he wanted the fate of Germany decided by Germans and not by the damn Jews in London. And the same thing with Tsar Alexander. And they both paid for it for their lives, and millions of their people paid for it with their lives. And America and Britain have been led around by the nose by these same Jews, and even 90% of identity won't even realize that they're the devil.
And especially Britain needs to learn that, you know, who the seed of the serpent are. And, you know, I thought, too, that maybe it should be stressed again that you can trace the descendants of Cain. You can trace them all the way from Esau's wives clear back to Cain in the Bible.
Absolutely.
And the place that you have to understand is the 15th chapter of Genesis towards the end of the chapter. There's something like the 18th, 19th, 20th verse in there someplace. It tells about the 10 Canaanite nations. It names 10 of them. Well, the next time it mentions those nations, it only mentions 7.
Right.
And even in the New Testament, it's 7. Continually after that, but the secret of knowing what happened there is the fact that three of the tribes of Canaanites was completely absorbed by the other 7. And the one that was completely absorbed by the other Canaanites were the Kenites, and that was descendants of Cain. So, after about the 15th of Genesis, from there on, when it says Canaanites, it's Cain is included, and every time it talks about Canaanites,
right. And it's very clear in the later, the Kenites just didn't disappear, and some idiots have claimed that the Kenites just disappeared because they're mentioned in Samuel, they're mentioned in Chronicles. They're mentioned several times after the mention of the seven nations of Canaan. And it's clear that they just blended in with the rest of the Canaanites.
And there's only way in one way in the Chronicles that they could be listed under Judah, as if some of them married some Judahites.
Well, you know, Judah, they're listed in Chronicles under Judah, but it says explicitly that they're Canaanites. And,
yeah.
And we have bad figs of Judah. And there's no doubt that that's the result of intermarriage between some of the tribe of Judah with Kenites and Canaanites. But it can also, you know, a lot of the Ephraim Skepta people love to point that out. However, if you read your damn Bible, you'll see that the Ephraimites also intermingled with a lot of the Canaanites, and it's in there. It's explicit. And that's why the prophet says that Ephraim is a cake not turned. A cake not turned is black on one side.
Yeah, a lot of people read that passage, and they don't know that. See, that's what these half-breeds, you know, our present, you know, quote, president, unquote, he's a cake unturned. He's half and half.
Absolutely.
He's black on one side and light on the other.
And that's exactly what happens to your pancakes when you leave them on the burner too long and you
yep.
turn them over.
And that's a Hebrew idiom, and if you don't understand the idiom, you don't know what it's talking about. And there's the trouble with the first three chapters of Genesis. They don't realize when it's talking about eat and touch, they don't realize that that's talking about sexual intercourse.
Well, I better break in here before we start talking about sex. We've kept it clean so far, gentlemen. It's all been about economics, right? Okay. So, Clifton Emenheiser, thank you very much for being on with Bill. And, you know, there's a great enlightenment here talking about how our people have been enslaved by the Kenites / Edomites / Canaanites. And, you know, we're in a situation today where the average, there's no doubt if you go to a restaurant crowded with people, you can't say the word Jew out loud. They've got our people so brainwashed.
Oh, I do it all the time.
Sorry. Well, I'm sure you do. In fact, it happened to me one time. I was at a restaurant with a friend and I was talking about the Jews, and I was being fairly loud. And it turned out that day there was a Jew right behind me. He turned around and said, "I resent what you're saying." I said, "Oh, you must be a Jew." And I said, "I'm not going to stop saying what I'm saying because it's the truth, you know." And so there was nothing he could say to that. And I never saw him in that restaurant again. Okay. Well, Clifton, thanks for joining us today and being part of our 999 marathon to awaken our people, Israel. And Bill, stay alert for another couple hours. You got one more show to do, okay?
Praise Yahweh.
Yes. And Clifton, any final words from you before we sign off?
Well, we need to get these British on 2C line.
Yes. Yes, that's for sure. The British,
because they gotta be a flame, and Esau's gotta be stubble.
Well, you know what, Clifton? I just got an email from one of our friends over there complaining about the direction that the British Israel church is going in. And I said to her, just a few years ago, the British Israelites were complaining that the Germans are Assyrians. Of course, that's a lie, you know.
Absolutely.
But now they're accepting Muslims and Turks and what have you, overnight they started, now they're no longer criticizing Germans for not being good enough Anglo-Saxons. Now they're accepting anybody. So something's really wrong there.
I got a good look at that guy that's the front man for the Canadian British Israel World Federation.
Yeah.
He's the straight kike. His name is Peter something.
Salemi.
Salemi or Salami or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, Salemi. Peter Salemi. Well, he looks like an Arab to me, but, I guess there's not that much difference.
Well, no, there's no racial difference. I mean, most Arabs are Canaanites.
Janelle is asking if BI is accepting anybody, and I guess it's true because, Peter Salemi, I mean, he's either an Arab or a Jew. There's no doubt about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he's the front man for the Canadian British Israel world. It's a damn shame. It's a crying shame.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So we have to pray for them, especially that, those people, you know, and they're watering down the message just as the churches, the mainstream Judeo churches, have done. And I guess they're getting pressure from above to do that. Yeah, but we're not going to change our message, folks. This is racial covenant Israel, and
well,
we're not going to change.
You know, the scripture says that that the house of Joseph is going to be aflame, so they got to turn up their torch too.
That's right. That's right. They got to turn up the torch. And we're also Israel will be Yahweh's battle axe, and you know those days are coming too. So we all have to be prepared and do our part when that day comes, but we can't jump the gun. It's all according to Yahweh's timing, okay? All right, thank you, Clifton. Thank you, Bill. Bill, I'll be talking to you in a couple hours, okay?
Praise
and
Yahweh.
Clifton, I'll talk to you whenever. Thanks
okay.
for being on again. Okay, praise Yahweh. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're at 10 minutes of the hour, and next show, my guest is going to be Jeff Weekly, also who has to spend time behind bars for his race. And he and I are going to be talking about the Jubilee, the Sabbath, the feast days, and how they apply to true Israel today and how we're supposed to obey Yahweh's laws, which the mainstream churches don't have any problem ignoring, and which, of course, the Jews break with regularity. And so that's going to be, again, we're going to switch programs to the 22187 at www.talkshoe.com. /TC/22187, and we'll see you in about 10 minutes. Okay, Yahweh bless everybody. If things are going smoothly, praise Yahweh for that.